At times.
I had forgotten, was that $15 a week we got? I had forgotten all about that.
I heard it was $12.50.
It was five zero.
We got $15 a week and we gave it to the people we stayed with.
Well, I got my check once a month.
That Scope sent it to the people we stayed with because.
You never got it?
No.
We actually got it.
Some people didn't get it, but what's funny, when I was doing research in the Library of Congress, it said we got paid $60 a month.
Yeah.
And sadly, when I talked to my son, he said, "Oh, they owe you $10."
I don't remember that one way or the other.
Well, it was the $50 was our stipend for the summer,
yeah.
And I spoke at different colleges for about 4 to 6 months after that. So I got it for 6 to 8 months. I got $50 to pay for gas.
I remember depositing money at the Scope House.
And what's funny is the woman said she signed her checks. The checks I got either had Dr. King's name on it, sometimes had Ralph Abernathy's name.
She signed them?
The common joke I've always had, I should have saved one of them.
Those would be more valuable.
I know.
Right.
That's what, I've used that joke for years.
Well, you know. Dick Revis wound up being the head of the project in Demopolis, and I think
in his book
he indicates he may have gotten one or two $12.50 checks that summer. So two at the most, so he got maybe $25.
But when I went back to New England, I kept getting the checks because I was going around New England speaking in colleges to recruit people. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't offered to become an SCLC staff or something, but that was my gas money, my hotel money or stuff, you know. Because that's when Motel 6 was worth $6.
Were they really? I never knew that.
That's where that name came from.
Who's in charge of John in charge?
Yeah, they really were six.
Is John in charge of this group? Is he leading it?
I don't know. They just told me to call.
Yesterday I told you there was something I wanted to ask you about. Something that I had heard you say.
Could you state your name, please, for the recorder?
Oh, this is Melzina Maddox. You were on the march in Mississippi.
No, I wasn't. I walked through Mississippi, but SNCC had already pretty much fallen apart, and so I wandered off and got in the anti-war movement.
Okay, but you didn't come to Grenada, huh?
No. I wasn't in Grenada.
Okay.
I was briefly in Winona and Greenwood. Briefly.
How did you get to Winona without coming through Grenada?
I hitchhiked from Arkansas and wound up in
Selma. Oh, yeah, you would have gotten there first.
Yeah.
Okay, now
yeah.
I know.
Okay.
All right. I'm John Runnels for the recorder set. I worked in Pike County, Alabama, and 65 and beyond, and worked with SCLC up to 1971, and was pretty much all over the place. So our topic is to talk about the challenges and the success of SCLC and the Scope project. Well, I will start off by saying I think that Scope was a success across the board.
We're passing it.
Because very few black people was registered to vote in 1965. And in Pike County alone, we registered over 5,000 people. So for me, that was a huge success. But some of the challenges, we had difficulty getting into churches for mass meetings and stuff like that, particularly the larger black church. It was easier to get into some of the rural churches than in the city. I think one of the other challenge that we faced in Hancock County was where to stand. People who was willing to take people in was told by the authorities, if you let this civil rights worker stay here, you're gonna lose your job. And they used the police force to try to intimidate people. Before 64, there was no black policeman in Troy or on the sheriff department. And they hired two black policemen who could only arrest or whatever black folks. They couldn't touch white people. And so one of the things they did during the scope thing was have those officers go around in the black community and intimidate folks. They went even on people's jobs. So that was some of the challenges. But the time was just right, and people just said, enough is enough. You know, and one of Jose's instruction was not to demonstrate unless you had to. And they kept denying us the ability to arrest register people. They put up all kinds of low games. And we had, originally we had one day a month. And so our first test was try to get more registration days. And so we marched on the courthouse demanding more voter registration. And the probate judge at the time was fearful that Troy and Pike County would become another cell. Mm-hmm. And he didn't want that. So he pulled every string that he could to get us more registration days. And I was in the room, and he would call Patterson office and say, we need more days here. We need more days. And that's how we were successful because, you know, he didn't listen to the governor. He just took up on himself, said, I'm gonna have a certain situation in my county. So he gave us more days. So that's, which way do you want to go? Do you want to go first?
No.
What's the question? My name is...
We're talking about successes and challenge of the LCN and scope.
My name is Richard Smiley. I started out working in Selma, Alabama, and that was before the voters bill was passed and after. And, you know, one of the things, after the voter bill was passed, they sent in federal registrars. And we could register people's Monday through Saturdays. And we would, on Saturday, have where all the people hang out and drink at clubs and stuff like that. We used to go into the clubs on Saturday, unplug the jukebox, and take people down to register to vote. know, some of them say that, you know, I'm drunk, I can't go. I say, let's go anyway. They're going to arrest me. I say, well, Dr. King will come get you out of jail. Just me alone, I was arrested about 20, 25 people a day. The other challenge was, is people was afraid. People was afraid, you know, one of the things we always say, they say, we praying, we tell them, okay, pray about it, get up off your knees, let's go register. You know, we had to be able to come up with whatever excuse they give. Joe Freeman did talked about some numbers and said out of 15,000 people was eligible to vote in Selma, only 156 were registered. So we registered, and there was some scope workers there, and they're not here. It was Janet Baker, Charles Baker, and Tish. And it was some more scope workers there. I don't remember the name. Arkansas was there. So we you know, with the Federal Register there, we got a lot of people registered. Okay. And the other county that I worked in, but the other city, it was Bibb County, Alabama. And the main city was West Blockton, Centerville, around that area. Myself, Sunshine, Willie Tabb was assigned there. And go back to somewhere where John was saying that once the sheriff found out we were living with some of the residents, they would come and ramshack the house. And we one day we was downtown of West Centerville trying to register people. And we observed that there was some white guys with shotgun walking around the courthouse while we were trying to register people. So we took off and went to Marion. But we found out that the sheriff had went and harassed people that was living there. In that particular county, they had a city called Brent. Brent was sort of like the bottom, were all blacks. I mean, they lived in this particular area. We wasn't allowed to go down there. So Mr. Brent owned the town. And if Mr. Brent said, kill them, they would kill us. Another guy that worked down in that area was Jerry Williams. They had a rally at the church, one of those churches. They had to carry, he had to dress like a lady, had to carry him out in the ambulance. Then just briefly on the other town I worked in was Dawson, Georgia, Terry County, Georgia, where they was killing the black every weekend. Even when we went in, there was blood on the sidewalk. It was Jackie Smith from Birmingham, Evelyn Williams from Selma, Pat Lancaster from, I think she was from California, and myself. And we went down there to try to register people. They would put a contract out on my life, a $200 contract, the mayor. When we first came into town, the sheriff arrested the car, didn't arrest us. They arrested the car. They let us go, but they put the car behind a big fence. We couldn't get into churches, wouldn't let us have meetings there. I remember one, we had a scheduled a mass meeting at one church. And when we got to the church, it was cars riding all around. So we couldn't have a mass meeting. Now I found out that after we left, they bombed houses, they bombed people's houses, burned people's houses. But eventually the guy that I was staying with, Mr. Holloway, he got elected as the county commissioner. Then the funeral home man got elected as mayor.
You mean eventually?
Eventually. And that's where, you know, I might have mentioned this morning that the movements was trying to get a 1966 civil rights bill through to protect civil rights workers, protect people that are trying to go out there and register the people and encourage people to register. And that's when the FBI told me there was no bloodshed. But if we look back, from where we started at and where the impact had up to date, we only had so many blacks elected officials in Alabama. We had about 400 or 500 all over the country. But if we look back, we got tens of thousands of African American elected officials now. And we look back, those are the seeds that we planted. We might not have been in the county, we might not have been there, but we planted the seed. So we look at the seeds we planted, the harvest that grown. You know, we might not could have seen it then, but we see it now. And if it wasn't for a scope, if it wasn't for a SCLC, we don't know what would have happened.
All right, I'm gonna move around the circle.
Okay, my name is Beth Pickens and I'm from UCLA and I was in Macon, Georgia. Now, I was only there part of the summer. I left about a week before the Voting Rights Act was actually passed. So I did do the canvassing. It was difficult, but we also wanted to find someone who could pass the literacy test as a test. And I had found someone on my canvassing and I went and talked to the woman. Because to get someone to do that wasn't easy. It's one thing to register when the law is passed, another thing to go down and pass that literacy test. So we had gotten the list of questions. I recall 10 for Macon, but I could be wrong. And it took a lawyer, I understand, about a day or so in a law library to get the answers. It was very onerous. I could do the first and the second question, simple after that. I couldn't even understand the question. So I found this woman who actually wasn't feeling well. I sat with her in her bedroom. She was in bed, and I sat beside her. And she was willing to go do it, and she wanted to. And I talked with her for a while. So I sat with her and helped her study the answers to the question. And she wasn't well. And I said, "Are you sure you want to do this?" Because she was just laying down this whole time. And she said yes, and I did take her down. I don't know, it might not have been the next day, because she really wasn't feeling too well. We did take her to the courthouse, and she did pass it. And they were not happy. but she did, and that's that was sort of, I guess, a test case. And, of course, a few weeks later.
I just want to, how many other of you tried to find people to pass your literacy test before you, okay? Mm-hmm. So who did you choose?
I don't know if you could get around to me, but there's a little history that goes with this. I'm Iris Rubin, and I was in Savannah, Georgia. And about 3 years prior to Scope, I think it was 3 years prior to Scope, Hosea led a campaign in Savannah to register voters, which was very highly successful. So unlike the rural counties, there was a very high percentage of African Americans who were already registered. So we went out on the streets. We were blessed with Big Lester Hankerson and the the limousine, kind of the funeral limousine, which he called the ballot bus, painted ballot bus on it, and used that to carry people to the registration office. So we did our soliciting on the street because there was such a high percentage of people already registered that we were trying to target a population that maybe had got missed or wasn't able to get registered the first time around.
I just want to stay with this quick. So who did you choose for your test?
Oh, we went to a church service and announced that we would have classes the next Saturday, on two different Saturdays, and maybe seven people came to the first one and maybe about the same number the second. And we went over writing names, basic questions, on civic questions. And I never did find out if it was successful or not, or, you know, that we did not get feedback from that.
Where was this?
This was in Southampton County, Virginia.
Oh.
And that's a question. Is this before the civil rights? I mean, the vote
yes,
bill
yes. Passed? Okay. It was a moot point after August 6th.
Okay.
We asked people after they, if they were successfully registered, then we asked them what questions they were asked. So then we could use those questions to educate the next person. So, but we didn't have a list of questions. And
somehow someone got
somebody
the,
got
the,
that.
The sheet. I, not me, but someone got it.
And in our case, we did the classes, too, but to do the test, we chose an English teacher with a master's degree. What do you think? Did she pass?
No.
She
no.
did not pass.
No,
federal judge did.
Yeah. Okay. You want to, did you finish your thought?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Steve Press from the university. We went to Orangeburg, South Carolina. I wish there was somebody else here from my group, just because I would have liked to see them. But also, my memory ain't so great. I don't remember specifics and details a whole lot. And if two of us could talk about it by synergy, I think we'd remember a lot more. But I think in Orangeburg, as I listened to other people talk, we had a more benign experience. We were threatened and harassed. Never with weapons. Most of the time we stayed in the city of Orangeburg, which was segregated. There had been an active movement a few years before we got there, and part of our was NAACP, and then it kind of got moribund. They stopped doing much of anything. So part of our job that we to kind of be to help get it going again as the worker bees. They, you know, okay, you know, the leadership, the old leadership, the new leadership come in and said, this is what we need, this is what we want, this is what we'd like you to do to help us. We did that. And so I think that was a success. I think that that chapter got going again. We did voter registration, and for me, I remember that, or kind of the canvassing, much more in either in the rural parts of the county. We spent 2 weeks we divided up, and I spent 2 weeks in a small little town called Branchville, South Carolina. We stayed with a woman, single mom. She had maybe one kid, I don't remember that. And there would be harassment. It would be probably teenagers just driving back and forth in front of their houses. As far, nobody got shot, and they didn't shoot up the house. I don't know what happened after we left, of course. The city of Orangeburg, we stayed at two houses owned by the Catholic Church. I'm not sure it was an integrated church, I don't know. But they felt it as their kind of religious duty to provide this for us. It was at least mostly a white church. And today, I just had this thought. Did our presence there, did that have anything to do with the massacre at South Carolina State College several years later? The one that didn't get the kind of attention is Kent State. That was Kent State was 1970. I think SCSC was same year.
Same year.
No, like a week apart or something. February 8th, 1968.
So it's 2 years before
when they
Kent State.
Shot Glebe. Yeah.
Okay. So it was only 3 years after we were there.
Yeah.
I never even made a connection that our presence somehow did something. I don't know. I do not know the answer. Did we set off some triggers? Did we get people more, you know, organized and active, and then that set off triggers? I honestly don't know.
I don't know either, but I suspect that may have had something.
It may have had something to do with it.
To do with, because those students on the campus, you know, beginning to come off the campus, so.
We passed over Arkansas.
Yeah.
We'll get back to
you. I thought he was answering his question.
Yeah, no. All right.
Sorry.
Yeah, sure. Well, I showed up in Selma in January of 1965 and didn't know anything and just, you remember, I forget, but anyway, Mr. Christopher Wiley, Snickworker, took me out the very first day, you know, and I'm thinking, I want to get educated or trained or something, you know, come on, let's go. So we go out door to door and get started there. And then everything happened. I got thrown in jail for sitting on the white folks' side of the courtroom. I was convicted and thrown in a white cell, and the FBI came in and singled me and Mike Geisen out one at a time, so the other one would be beaten by the prisoners that Jim Clark passed out weapons to, and all of that. So that was my beginning. And then I led the internal security force for the March on Montgomery. And then right after that, everything was kind of falling apart. Everybody left town, and we're in Selma. How do we hold it together? Oh, there's a movement down in Camden. So I got sent down there to take some people down. Bruce Harper was one of the people.
What year is this?
65. And so we go down to Camden, and the kids had a demonstration. They hit us with tear gas, and I started singing, "Ain't gonna let no tear gas turn me around," and everybody came back, and so the cops decided to single me out. And there's a picture on the wall in there of me being beaten. They would have killed me that day, except the TV was there. So thank God for the TV. So then I wound up, I got out and came to Atlanta. And I went down to Perry, Georgia to organize a mass meeting. And I started working with Scope in the beginning. But Jose has sent me up north, right in the middle of the training, to recruit more people. So I missed the last half of the training and got back, working my way back down because I had no money. Martin Luther King personally gave me $25 and a plane ticket to Atlanta. He said, "Give him hell, Arkansas," and he sent me back. Well, Henry Haskins had asked for me in Demopolis. I wasn't actually part of Scope's staff. I just came down there to help. And so Henry was, he was a cement finisher with, like his father, and he was the main head of the movement in Marengo, in Demopolis, kind of like Albert Turner and Perry was a bricklayer. And so Dick Revis got elected head of the Scope people because he was the only male. And that's the way they kind of did things. And his book here is now out of print, but I'll pass it around. He gives a pretty good picture of what happened. I'm the only person who went out into the county and went out in the plantations and down at Sweetwater and Linden and various places to bring people in. Well, Henry had called for a mass march to demand employment for black people in downtown Demopolis. And then when the day came for the march, the church was filled. I'd been out working, a lot of people, 200 people in the church, and Henry didn't show up. So I started the singing, and we started coming down the stairs of the church, and the police singled me out again and beat the hell out of me. And I didn't even remember that because it was so similar to Camden. My mind just put the two into one. I didn't know it until Revis wrote the book about it, that, oh, I've been beaten up in Demopolis, too. So I'm in jail in Demopolis, and they wouldn't back me up to get me out. So Miss Lena Frost, your basic local movement woman, undercover, I mean, you know, quiet, but did the real work, she and Dick Revis and J. Joe Nathan and Charlie Salzberg went around door to door collecting quarters and nickels, and they finally got $200 to get me out of jail. They come to get me out, it's 10 o'clock Saturday night, and I come one step out, and Sergeant Johnson, Arkansas. I said, what? He said, you got any proof of gainful employment, boy? I said, you wouldn't give me my billfold back when I got out of jail. What? You ain't carrying no ID? You under arrest.
Oh.
What for? Vagrancy. Vagrancy in Alabama was a felony. So I get thrown back in jail, 2 o'clock in the morning. They come down from Linden, three deputy sheriffs, and they chain me up to two. I'm a 300-pounder on this side, and I knew the one on this side, Ernie Lolly. He had spoken at a KKK rally at Chickasaw State Park, 600 KKKers, three Grand Dragons, and he named me by name, saying he's going to kill me. Well, the black folks in Demopolis had given me this clue, and they... And so here I am chained up to him, and he's sticking his gun in my ribs, and I won't use all the words, but he said, you feel that? You better go for it. We're going to take,
I want to hear the story.
I was trying to, okay. I mean, I was already streamlined. I disappeared, and the book indicates Revis never saw me again, and mm-hmm. I would like to how I got out.
She want more.
Okay, well, I was in for a number of weeks incommunicado. They lied to the people in Demopolis. They said they released me, and I went home to Arkansas. And here I was incommunicado down in Linden. Well, Jimmy Collier, the folk singer, after he'd been touring with Martin Luther King, he came back and the police arrested him. And he heard them bragging about having me in jail down in Linden. So when the bail bondsman came to get him out, he said, hey, we're going down to Linden to get out of Arkansas. So they got me out at midnight on my 21st birthday, dropped me off in Selma. And so I walked to the Freedom House, 2 o'clock in the morning, thop, thop, two rifles and shotguns stick out. And who's there? Arkansas, all the guns cocked. Silas Norman saved my life that night, because he identified me. Oh, Arkansas, hey, we got a brother, put down your guns. Well, I just learned today that he died in July of this year. His sister was the world famous opera singer. He identified me and rescued me. Well, so there I was in Selma, so I started working with SNCC, and I went out with Richard and some other people out in the lower Dallas County near G's Bend across the river. And then the FBI came and drugged me out and threw me in, and they were torturing me down in Mobile. And I got a phone call smuggled out to Stokely Carmichael, and he called Byard Rustin, and eventually I got due process after about a month and a half in jail. I went home to Arkansas. My home church tried to kill me. They had a plot to do a lobotomy, and eventually, 20 seconds. Eventually, I got. I'm trying.
He's going to get about half of my time later, so we'll get back to Arkansas.
Eventually, I survived that plot, and I came back to Selma, and then Stokely assigned me to work in Utah. And so I was there, but I was under such trauma, I had to go north for a while.
Sure. You'll get more time. Okay, your turn.
Sorry.
I'm Carlson.
Before you start, let me say, we have less than a half an hour.
I don't talk that much.
And so try to make it quick, because we want to come up with some strategy to go back and report, okay?
We got four more people. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't have good stories like that, but I'm Carlson. I was in Birmingham, and it wasn't really a scope project. It was a long-going project that Miles College had done. They had some help from Democratic, we didn't have the Freedom Democratic Party yet, but there were Democrats that considered themselves, some black Democrats that considered themselves the real Democrats. And so they were active in voter registration with the Miles Project, and And things were pretty well organized around Jefferson County there. Most of the help in canvassing was young people, mostly women, but like high school age and entering college age, who had been part of the children's movement, who had faced all those fire hoses and stuff. So they weren't intimidated easily, and we didn't really have many confrontations I knew about. But part of our canvassing, we'd probably at least one rural area in the county every week. We'd go out virtually every day to different parts, mostly urban. Things were pretty redlined in the city, so we knew where the where one community, one population stopped and the next one started. So there'd been a lot of clear thinking ahead of time. So and I stayed there after the Voting Rights Act passed on the 6th. But we had stopped our canvassing by that time. But part of what we did in our canvassing, we had copies of the sample questions that they might be asked. And if people's indicated interest, there were people that would do follow-up work and more intense preparation, because it was hard to prepare people for the pop quizzes. I think there was like 100 different random questions that series of questions they got to ask, and they're multiple choice or simple ones. There was a part of the Constitution and interpret it, and if their interpretation was right. That was my experience. It was all, everything was good. It was a nice progressive community. That's why they call it Bombing Man.
Bombing Man.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, my name is Rugsy Ruggiero. The biggest success we had, because that was the question, what were the successes of SCOPE and SCLC? Nobody's mentioned it yet. I'll list the 6-1. Dr. King was against the war in Vietnam. I didn't need to know anything. I was against the war in Vietnam. That's one of our successes. I always felt so bad because when you go to the Library of Congress, SCOPE registered 49,000 people in 65, and Joe finally set the record straight. I felt so bad because we didn't hardly register. She says that number's a lot less. We have the Civil Rights Act of 64. We have the Voting Rights Act of 65. Those are our 4 successes. Our one failure was the war on poverty. We won all of the battles from 1964 through 1980. In 1980, 30 million people were poor. Today, that number is 44 million. And just like when the head of SCLC talked, and with all that energy, I have to tell you, the success nobody has mentioned. Let's go back to the 50s. Okay, what were the 50s? The Surgeon General said, smoking is not harmful for your health. Yeah, right. And yet, these same mental midgets at Harvard and Yale, they wrote books showing that the Negro's brain could not think. Because, you see, here's the skull. They had pictures of it. They even went so far to say the Negro was the missing link between the ape and modern ape. BS! We proved that once and for all. The Negro wasn't inferior 10 minutes ago, 10 seconds ago, 10 years ago. And we proved it way beyond a reasonable doubt. I'm still too feeble to go around and hug each of you. When I give my speech, I always try to get people to laugh, because before I said that part, I always say, the one thing I'd pat myself on the back if I could reach it. And you are the reason. Because when the kid is killed in Ferguson, we don't ever have to go to the thing, well, he deserved it. White people really realize that isn't true. We're in the 50s when there were only 3 channels. The Negro couldn't think. The Negro wasn't a full human being.
And
our civil rights work disproved that once and for all, way beyond a reasonable doubt. And my memory is bad, so that's why I write things down. The other 2 points I want to make, I use Dr. King's words, like even the Pope used Dr. King's words. Like, we were given a bad check. the Negro. Like, in other words, when the Civil War ended, Lanny had it up there on his screen. It went by real quick. All men are guaranteed, white men, as well as black men, were given the rights. And 100 years later, that check didn't get cashed. And then the last thing, which is my personal crusade, and I'll be going through with Lanny, the four girls who died in Birmingham, we need to get their names out. In other words, you mention Anne Frank. Everybody knows of the Jewish girl who died because she never got to be free living under Nazi rule. You know, we got Cynthia Wesley. We got Denise McNair. We got Adie May Collins. And we got Carol Robbins. I want high schools named after these kids. My name's Ruxy Ruggiero, and I'm happy to meet all of you. Okay.
We're happy to meet you.
I'm Jennifer Westman. I don't have too much to say at this point, other than I'm kind of concerned about the state of voting rights. I don't think that anyone doubts that if everybody in this country voted, that there would be no Republican Party left. It would be in shreds. And they're doing everything they can to keep most people from voting, the people that will put them out of power. They've already started with the Supreme Court decisions recently, and I'm sorry, not Supreme Court decisions, with the legislation passed last summer, I believe, which is very concerning to me. So we had great successes in 65. It's starting to be taken away again, and I think something needs to be done about it, and that's all I have to say about that.
Well, earlier today,
Cookie.
Oh, my name is Melzinia Maddox, and everybody has always known me as Cookie. Earlier today, I spoke about a group of people at SCLC that nobody thinks about. Right. And that was the staff, the staff of women who took care of the staff of men from Dr. King on down, including Richard and John. Okay, the most important thing we did, and that was my job, was to make sure that they had what they needed and occasionally got paid those few little pennies that they made. But there was a couple other things I want everybody to know. And when you talk about whether we were successful or not, these are two things that we as women in that office were successful about. The nation was changing. It was changing everywhere, especially when it came to black people. We were struggling to identify ourselves, you know, and to determine whether we were colored or whether we were Negroes or whether we were African Americans, and just who are we, you know? We had been called by many things by many people, but we needed to discover who we were ourselves. Now, every day after I left Mississippi, I went to work in heels and stockings. And I did my hair, however terrible it might have been, I did it. You know, most of the time I just burn it out. I wish you all could see my pictures. My hair was just, it was a mess because I was not good at that. I was the youngest of three sisters. So, of course, I was taken care of a lot better. But one Saturday, we were at the office. And I don't know why we were there on a Saturday, but we were. And I remember telling somebody that I think I'm going to get my hair cut because black people across the nation had started to wear their hair natural. And a lot of people didn't understand that. Of course, they didn't understand hippies either, but they didn't understand why would we do that. So I said, well, I'm going down the street to the barber shop. Remember the barber shop down the street from SCLC and the pool hall and stuff? So I said, I'm going down here. I'm going to get my hair cut. And Francis, who was Andy Young's secretary at the time, said, Cookie, if you get your hair cut, I'll get mine cut too. Okay? So I said, okay, I'm going to do it, you know? So I went and did it. And we were so happy that we did that. We finally came out of the heels and the stockings and the necessity for dresses. We started to wear the bell bottoms like everybody else. And the reason why I call this a success was because that was the weekend. At that weekend, we would never see Dr. King alive again. And we were so proud of ourselves. that we literally changed the face of our office. And I was so proud that we changed the face of our office because so many of the girls in the office were secretaries. And secretaries are supposed to be neat and pretty and nice and all of that. But the field staff who came in from Alabama and who came in, they were not neat. That sometimes they were dirty. Sometimes they may not have had any place to bathe. You know, they may have had to sleep in a field with some cows, like I did one time with Leon Hart and Lester and some other people who were running and wanted to make sure that the state troopers didn't catch us. So that's what we did. And that was truly a success. We were just, oh, we wanted to see Dr. King walk through the door. We wanted to see his face. We wanted him to be so proud. But he never got a chance to see us. But we were successful because we changed our attitude. We changed our attitude about the people who worked in the field. We changed our attitudes about ourselves. You know, we got to a point to where we started to learn to accept who we were because we defined who we were.
You were the pioneers of the women's movement.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Very good.
I guess that's absolutely. Thank you. One more thing about these women. When after Dr. King died, and so many people came to Atlanta, so many people, I had never seen so many people in all my life. We were asked to give up our seats in the church so that those who were dignitaries would have a seat. And so, of course, we were civil rights workers. We said yes, you know. However, the church is like a block up the street from the office at 334 Auburn Avenue. So we're standing there, you know, in front of the office, and we're waiting for the wagon to come and the mules and here comes Leon and Dr. King's little boys, and everybody is marching. But they didn't notice us. They didn't notice us at all. So believe you me, being from Mississippi has its perks. I don't mind speaking about anything that's on my mind. Sometimes, well, most of the time, it gets me in trouble, but I do it anyway. So I'm out there screaming, stop this march, stop this march, and let us in this line. And that's how we got in it. Otherwise, we never would have been able to be in the march that took Dr. King to his resting place. And I think about that sometime, and I tell my children, one of these days, you know, you're going to look up the Time magazine, and you're going to see your mom, you know, because we stopped that line that day. You know, and we managed to march behind
that wagon. Is it in the magazine specifically?
Hmm?
Is it in the magazine?
It's on the front cover.
It's on the front cover.
Yeah.
Okay.
And if you get one, I'm in blue.
Yeah.
I went. My boss sent me shopping for a dress because I had become a downright hippie. Sent me shopping for a dress, and I had the most expensive thing I had ever bought in my life. I paid $125 for this outfit at Davidson's, and I wore it once.
Yeah.
That's the only time.
Is that Time magazine?
Can I ask a question? We talked about the successes and we talked about the challenges. Now, you know, we've been successful because we got a lot of people registered. We know that there's a lot of black elected officials. But the challenge right now is that the people we fought for, got beat for, died for, don't go out and vote now. That's our challenge for 2016.
Yeah.
You know, Republican, Democrat, they don't vote. And I think, you know, the challenges that we have to talk about is why these people don't vote.
I spent some time in North Carolina, actually 8 years in North Carolina, but I think like so many other states, the legislation was so repressive and so, you know, for restricted voting rights and a lot of other things. But there's a real clear message that, you know, people should not vote. And I think that
particularly in the less advantaged communities, both black and white. They're very intimidated. People are intimidated by that. The photo ID thing in North Carolina and everywhere else, where people had to have certain identification in order to get the government identification. There was a 92-year-old woman and an African-American woman and who spoke at the weekly rallies at the legislative building, and she said, I'm 92 years old, and I went to register on the day that I was eligible, and I was told to ask if I knew what was in the preamble of the Constitution, and I very proudly stood up straight, and I recited the preamble to the Constitution. And now they're telling me at this age I can't vote because I don't have a birth certificate. Well, how stupid are these people? You know, the babies were born at home.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't registered. They didn't have birth certificates. That hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. You know, so it just made me, you know, first of all, I was so proud of her and in awe of her. But I think the level of intimidation that comes about because one doesn't have the one thing that they need in order to vote, I think it holds people back, and it's our job to help people come out.
Well, that's why they pick the birth certificate.
Let me come in on two things.
If you don't drive.
The one of the things we forgot, and, you know, you have to sort of watch out. Dead white people have been voting for years.
Yeah.
Especially
right.
Chicago.
Okay. Dead white people have been voting for years. Yeah. Even after the voting bill was passed, when black people ran for office, they were not elected.
Yeah. Not voted.
And I understand there's some issues in terms of ID. But we got to think outside the box. If we don't have ID, more dead people are going to vote than African-American people are going to vote. So, let me just say something. It's a sacrifice, everything you do. So, you have to balance your sacrifice wherever that is.
I'm not sure there's that much voter fraud in this country. I have never been shown any evidence of that. I think it's been used by Republicans to scare people, saying that illegals are voting. I don't think it happens.
And most studies say it's not. The percentage is so low.
About one out of a million. About that.
Okay, understand, when they went to touch screens, those touch screens were produced by a Republican company. And so they could simply, with a digital thing, say 52% voted that way and 48, and they could hit a switch. They've fixed that problem, so there is voter fraud. I mean, because we don't have hanging chads. We don't have a physical ballot to prove.
Right, in Pennsylvania, the voter ID thing has been overturned, but so many people who have registered or who could register believe that it's still in existence. So it's hard. It's kind of hard to talk them into going to register anyway. We have a lot of stuff that has to be undone, and we're the folks to do it.
Arkansas.
Yep. We're talking about tactics and processes. I'd like to go more into strategy. And Elizabeth spoke last night so powerfully about blending the arts in with the political understanding and the history and the movement. And she's an actress and poetry and song. And how do you get the younger generation who's not already aware from what they happen to have stumbled into, or parents or history books, how do we get them to be actively involved and concerned? Because number one, they're disgusted. Number two, they're distracted. And number three, they're disinterested. So that's what song and poetry and history and all of that is about, to give people an understanding about how do you participate in making a better life for yourself and for the people you live with. And I think that's absolutely crucial. I've been banned from teaching because I'm a historian and I live history. And I still want to, but it's been frozen out and I keep trying. But I think she brought it terrifically last night, and I think that's a piece, a necessary piece of the equation.
It would be interesting.
Go ahead.
It would be interesting if you could get some major hip-hop artists to start rapping about that. Yeah. When I was in Dakar, Senegal, I was in Gori Island, and I was let into a private thing. I was one of the very few Westerners there. And it was an African rap band. Of course, unfortunately, they were rapping in French, but I was with some people who could translate. But I could pick up enough that they were talking about the slave trade in the United States' involvement in it. So why don't our hip-hop artists, instead of the violence and the inner-city stuff, start bringing it to the kids that way? I don't have any connections there. I'm just a suggestion.
I think that's great. Rock the Vote was not, I don't think it was so much rap artists, but
no,
that
you need
was
the rappers. Go get Kanye West and some of these guys to do something. They got plenty of money.
So I've been having this thought that's kind of starting to gel now, that maybe we need to have another Scope project. And not so much aimed at the South, although that would be included, but aimed at states that have restrictive voting rules. And just do the kids now, I'm too old for that, the kids now, there's other stuff I'm going to be doing and have them do it. The kids now go to these states, and I'm not sure what the strategy or tactic is, this is just a brand new idea I had, but we aim at changing those laws, we aim at, you know, overturning that. Because that's the problem. You know, you have the right to vote if you can show ID, and the kind of ID, and the people who don't have ID, we know who they are, and we know why. You know, and the, you know, they're not stupid. That's the problem. The 92-year-old woman, she said they were stupid. I don't agree with that. They're very smart, and they're doing it deliberately.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. Can I ask you to do a favor, since you had the pad? Mm-hmm. Could you be our scribe? We had one suggestion over here about using rap music. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is there somebody who writes better than I do?
I do.
Just do it.
Okay. So, Arkansas, by the way, I went to a workshop. I'm a social worker, but I went to a workshop done by people who use rap music in therapy, in mm-hmm. group therapy. And I think I don't think it's that hard to do. I think that those are the folks who would easily be able to...
You have to get to them and explain it.
I think it's very possible. It's a great idea.
I think Frank Sinatra...
So, we got the arts. The gentleman over here is saying, which I think we should do, that Scope, that we need to re-energize it. Because we still have something to contribute, and we should meet more often, even if we have to do it on a regional level. But
for teleconference,
mm-hmm. I mean, we can get. And just one other thing about in terms of the art and rapping, we have some folks in the family. Elizabeth as. Was saying, is an actress. Yeah. Her husband is an actress.
Right.
Donna Lee Abernathy is an actress professionally. Martin III is out there doing something. So we got some resources.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We could do some theater.
Yeah.
And I, a professional singer.
I would like to put out also to add the thing from the March on Washington, the economic, we need jobs. Because, in other words, if you're going to organize a thing the same way we did for Scope, so besides doing the voting, the economic gives us a much better base, because everybody needs good paying jobs.
Mm-hmm. May I bring up one other thing?
Go ahead.
That's something that bothers me. Every time I see President Obama, and I really love him, I wrote him 2 letters. He didn't write me back, but I love him anyway. I don't like the fact that he is described purely as an African American. I don't like that. That totally disregards his mother. Yeah. With the number of interracial couples that we have in this nation, we've got to find a new word.
Yeah.
And I think we need to use the word biracial or multiracial or something. Because right now I have an Indian statue sitting on my coffee table. My grandfather's picture's hanging on the wall, and he, I'm sorry, fellas, but he looks better than y'all. You know? He's a good-looking man, but he could have passed for white in a New York minute. You know? And at the same time, I have look at my father, who's definitely, whose African background is fine. But anytime I hear white people in the South discussing the rebel flag, it tugs at my heart, because I have some grandparents somewhere who were Southerners. Anytime I see trash all over the place, I went somewhere with somebody today, and I said, this is not right. Over where the Hispanics live, garbage everywhere. That's my Indian part of me saying, I don't like this. I love this earth. I want it clean. Same thing with Charleston. I tell everybody, go Charleston. It made me mad when I got to Charleston that they had not cut the grass like they should have or picked up the trash like they should have. And then there's me, who's African, who feels everything, and I love it.
I got one more suggestion. I think it's just, you know, we just give an opinion. I think that SCOPE should come together as a nonpartisan group, organized that we'll do nonpartisan get out the vote. And the reason I said nonpartisan, that you can get money to do that. And we could spread that money out all over the country and target certain areas and do get out the vote nonpartisan.
I like it.
That makes sense.
You haven't said anything in a little while.
Oh, you know, I said it. Well, you were gone when I made my little speech about how the Voting Rights Act is being gutted. Mm-hmm. And it seems that the Supreme Court is upholding that. I'm not really sure why. But we need to do something about that. That's what I said before.
You got to write your congressman, because the Supreme Court wants Congress to change.
The president said in Selma, if you don't vote, you're giving up your power.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't vote, you're giving up your power. You
that's
know?
A good rant.
So
it is.
So and that's basic. That was basic. The theme of Selma in March. If you don't vote, you give up the power. And the thing is that we done gave up our life, we done sacrificed, and people don't go to the poll. Now, it's a number of reasons, I'm not gonna get off into that, why people don't go to the poll, but I don't think it's just the Republican, all right? I think it's other reasons. The Democrats haven't been accountable for what they're supposed to do either.
Oh, no. Maybe Bernie Sanders will get people, I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe he'll get
but
people.
But waking up the people culturally, like 50 years ago, we had Marvin Gaye, we had Bob Dylan, we had Bonnie Raitt, we had, you know, people were giving that message into the culture and exciting people.
Yeah.
And Joan Baez, yeah, my buddy. And there are a few rappers who are starting to do that the last 5 years or so. But that kind of consciousness, I mean, some of us can actually do it, or our children can do it. Otherwise, we got to get the message out to where those who have the current talents and skills will pick that up and make that a cause, celebrate. I mean, that's what we did back then.
Musically,
the show would be fantastic.
We could maybe get to use Gloria from the movie Selma as a theme and get somebody to do your thing.
Right. The other thing is that we got to look at, we're dealing with, when we talk about the 60s, John Baez and all this, it was a different day. Music was about peace. Well, music was about freedom and love. But, you know, music has changed now. So when you start talking about using music and art, who are we trying to get out to vote? We got to think about Who are we talking to? What age range?
Well, you got to take a variety, because Taylor Swift writes a song you're in.
But I'm 67 years old. There's no rap guy going to make me motivate me more.
Well, we talk, if we go in that direction, we talk with a variety of musicians.
Yeah.
And different musicians target different audiences, and they, you know.
I need some amazing grace.
Richard, television is everybody's world. The machines like this, everybody's world. Talk shows, everybody's world. So each of us has our own world. But suppose you had a bunch of people out in the streets who's actually asking people, are you going to vote? You don't have to tell us who you're going to vote for. And basically making people discuss
voting. That's what I was talking about.
That to me would help a lot. And like you say, I'm not going to listen to Taylor Swift. I'm so sorry. I'm not going to listen to rap.
I may have heard one of her songs. I'm talking about the two generations ago.
But the fact is that young people will. Young people will listen to Taylor Swift. You know,
they will. That's
so
what I mean.
Absolutely. Just like we listen to Marvin Gaye, they'll listen to her. You know, so there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And then, too, we're not the group who want to say, okay, we're going to go vote anyway, because we fought to vote.
Right.
But it's that next generation, our 40-year-olds, who just are downright lazy.
I suggested some in a group, like in the state of Florida. You know, we have early voting.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to the voter registration in the county. They said that it's against the law for you to bring early voter voted at college and campus. And that's what I'm going to pursue when I get back to Florida. I'm going to start lobbying trying to change that law where we can bring voting.
If it's a law. It may not be.
Yeah.
All of us who have property, just let your kids know, if you don't go to vote, you're not in my will.
Good idea.
And on the music side, one other thing, in other words, we were only 350, and there were 350 staff or whatever. That should be the focus. Let them come up with the ideas,
mm-hmm.
whether it's rap, whether it's voting, whatever. Mm-hmm. In other words, look what we did and we still do. So if we could get kids involved, let them choose the issues. I mean, I think that would be
a thing.
And they
do most of it on media anyway. Right.
Yeah, I know.
They do it on the music thing.
Pray for Jimmy Collier. He's not doing very well right now. He couldn't make it here. And here's me and him on the march on Montgomery.
All right. Now let's go back to the group, the larger group, and report. Thank you, guys.